Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14 this Tuesday, May 14th, 2024. South Sudan's deadly intercommunal attack in Akobo has left several people dead.
During this time, these are the people who come and took children, and also they kill people on the way when they come and attack those of Akobo.
And Juba has welcomed its first ever sign language training center.
There are many, many, many places, like in the villages, they are undermining the hearing impairment person. It will be a great opportunity here in South Sudan because of this sign language. It will be easier for the police and a hearing person to understand each other.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. In a recent assault on Jongole State's Akobo County, allegedly involving armed young men from the Greater Pibor administrative area, five people were killed and several others injured. The county commissioner says the attack happened Monday morning. Viola Elias reports for VOA from Juba.
Residents of Akobo awoke to the sounds of gunfire and the panic cries of their neighbors as armed men descended on their village. Nyadin Kun recounts the chaos that ensued, with communities gripped by fear of more attacks by armed youth from neighboring Bibor.
Some men ran early in the morning around 6 and they also fired some guns to inform others. Yeah, the gunshots are here in the morning. They ran to rescue the rest, so we're just waiting for the feedback. Others, they just went after me, carrying guns, go to that side. Yeah, they are carrying guns and running to the side of Nyandi. Actually, people, they're not that much well. Others, they lost their family.
John Lamtud, pastor at the Presbyterian Church in Akobo, decries the breach of peace and reconciliation efforts by armed youth from Bibor. He called for intervention to prevent further bloodshed.
During this time, these are the people who come and took children, and also they kill people on the way when they come and attack those of Akobo. As a pastor in the church, this is a violation of peace between this, and I don't know, I am not sure about the use of Akobo, if there is a use of Akobo going to that area. But what I know, this is an accident took place in Akobo.
Commissioner Pope Nyang Tujek reports the assaults began around 5 a.m. in Nyandit Payam. Despite the community's effort to repel the attackers, Tujek says exploded guns fire continues to echo through Akobo town.
The attack in Nyandit Payam at 5. In that attack, 5 people were confirmed dead, and also there were some wounded people. So the fighting was still on because the youth from Akobo town right to the scan, and then they begin to fight back, and then they put the attackers into nearby bushes. So people are still hearing the sound of guns in Akobo town.
Chief Administrator Gola Boyoi of the Greater Bibor Administrative Area refutes this claim, alleging it was Akobo youth who initiated the assault. He accuses assailants from Akobo of abducting women and says there is an urgent need for dialogue and to condemn the violence.
They are now currently in Peshawar. No, why are they trying to come up with a counter plan so that later on they will justify their attack? Not this morning. They have been attacking people all this long. And up to now we have 11 people killed and 12 injured. And they took 9 children and women.
Boyoi implores authorities in Akobo to denounce the violence and collaborate on peace-building initiatives. He also stressed the importance of holding the perpetrators accountable.
For us as a government, if we are not honest with ourselves, we need to condemn our people before other people condemn them. So these are the things that have to be discussed. If there is any peace conference again between the Jungle State and Greater Bibor State area, we have to put this as one of the prerequisites for us to have peace. Because with this denial, we can never have peace. Why are we protecting criminals?
Efforts continued by the United Nations mission in South Sudan and local authorities to encourage dialogue and peaceful coexistence among the conflicted parties. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias reporting from Juba.
is still in Juba. Juba has welcomed its first sign language training center, with government officials and police officers among the first students. As Denise Logoni reports from the capital, the center will train hearing people to communicate with deaf people and open opportunities for them.
The new Sign Language Training Center presents an opportunity for enhanced communication between the hearing impaired community and society at large. Peter Kachinga, chairperson of the South Sudan National Association of the Deaf, conveyed his delight through an interpreter.
There are many, many, many places, like in the villages, they are undermining the hearing impairment person. It will be a great opportunity here in South Sudan because of this sign language. It will be easier for the police and a hearing person to understand each other. The challenges we are facing is that the family, parents, they are not understanding the sign language. And also the same thing, the teachers at the school, they are not well trained about the sign language.
There are more than 200,000 people in South Sudan with hearing loss. Esther Piro is a disability inclusion facilitator and advocate at Light for the World, an international humanitarian organization focusing on education and economic empowerment in South Sudan.
With this facility, people from our 10 states and their administrative areas will get us an opportunity to come and learn so that they go back to their own home land and introduce what is called sign language for children who are now excluded out of school because of the barrier of communication.
Henry Sule Felix, a COSI enrollee, hopes learning sign language will help him bridge the communication gaps within his community.
The reason why I took an interest for learning the sign language because my role advocating for the inclusion in the society, the issue of sign language, South Sudan is a big problem that need to be taken into concern, where we see our brothers and sisters who are hearing impaired get access to information. It's a big challenge. So that's why I need to learn this language so that the community I'm in, we have many people with hearing impairment so that they may be able to get information.
Sign language interpreter Jocelyn Knight Grace sees the center as a step toward a future where communication barriers are overcome through enhanced sign language proficiency.
As an interpreter, it's really very important to give information to people with hearing impairment because this is one of the community among our society which has been left out in terms of information sharing. So as an interpreter, you need to continue learning so that you'll be able to give a proper information to persons with hearing impairment. Because here in South Sudan, you'll find that many people are not interested in this field as they see it is a field which is not supporting them and it is time wasting.
Huda Michael Laila, the Minister of Gender, Child and Social Welfare in Central Equatoria State, says the government wants to enhance sign language accessibility.
We are very happy because of that center, and we will be committed and we will support the center so that the center will be functional for South Sudan, and also the same activity will be taken to the counties because the people are coming from the counties.
Augustino Udu Ilario, chairperson of the Organization of Persons Living with Disability, stressed the importance of promoting sign language.
There is a need to take the child language to the state. The need of interpreters is very high. We cannot be inclusive with that language, and we need to take sign language as one of the important languages, like English, like Arabic. This is why we need to promote sign language right from our families.
The initial phase of training courses will be offered free, with subsequent phases open to private individuals and institutions for a fee. The training center is a collaborative effort between the South Sudan National Association of the Deaf, Light for the World, and the Community Empowerment for Progress organization. The Association for the Deaf will manage the center with support from Light for the World in providing trainers, materials, and sustainability measures. For VOA News, this is Dennis Logoni reporting from Juba.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he is gravely alarmed by fighting in recent days between the Sudanese army and the rival paramilitaries in the key Darfur town of El Fasher, his spokesperson said on Monday. The international community has recently warned of a looming offensive on El Fasher, the last major city in Darfur that is not under control of the paramilitary, the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Farhan Haq, a spokesperson for the Secretary General, said that Guterres is alarmed by reports of the use of heavy weaponry in densely populated areas, resulting in dozens of civilian casualties, significant displacement, and the destruction of civilian infrastructure. The UN chief is particularly concerned for civilians in the area who, quote, are already facing a looming famine and the consequences of over a year of war, Haq said. He repeated Guterres's call for an immediate ceasefire and for all the parties to allow civilians to move to safer areas and facilitate unimpeded humanitarian access. Since April 2023, Sudan has been gripped by a devastating conflict between the army, headed by the country's de facto leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the paramilitary RSF, commanded by his former deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. Fighting broke out on Friday and ran into the weekend, with airstrikes in the north and east of al-Fashir as well as artillery fire, according to residents interviewed by the news agency AFP. On Friday alone, the UN said clashes between the army and the RSF left at least 27 people dead and 130 injured. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at a new displacement report featuring Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay tuned.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center reports conflicts and violence have pushed the number of internally displaced people to a record-breaking high of 75.9 million people, with nearly half of all IDPs living in sub-Saharan Africa. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report finds conflicts in Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Gaza accounted for nearly two-thirds of new displacement movements in 66 countries in 2023. The lead author of the newest report, Vicente Anzalini, says the number of internal displacements, that is, the number of times people have been forced to move because of conflict, has increased in the past few years, and this added to the total number of IDPs at the end of 2023. He says the new internal displacements in 2023 were mostly the result of the conflict in Ukraine, which started in 2022, along with violence in the DRC and the eruption of war in Sudan. That conflict resulted in 6 million newly displaced Sudanese people, adding to the millions there who had previously been forced from their homes.
As you know, it's more than a year that this new wave of conflict erupted. And as of the end of last year, the figure was 9.1 million. And just to flag that, this figure is the highest that we have ever reported for any country. These 9.1 million internally displaced people.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, a part of the Norwegian Refugee Council, produces an annual survey of displacements. The report covers the number of new displacements in 2023, the number of repeated displacements, when a person must flee more than once in the year, and the number of people who had previously been displaced and remained unable to go home. The report says hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza were uprooted from their homes multiple times, leading to 3.4 million displacements in the last 3 months of 2023. This is 17% of total conflict displacements worldwide during the year. Sudan tops last year's list of countries with the largest number of conflict-displaced IDPs, followed by Syria, the DRC, Colombia, and Yemen. Additionally, in 2023, the report says 7.7 million people were internally displaced by natural disasters, including floods, storms, earthquakes, and wildfires. Anzalini says many countries that have experienced conflict displacement also have experienced disaster displacement.
In many situations, they are overlapping. This is the case in Sudan, in South Sudan, but also in Somalia, in the DRC. So you can imagine fleeing from violence to save your life and then having to expect to escape to higher ground with whatever you can carry as a storm or a flood threatens to wash away your temporary shelter.
He adds the sad reality is observed in many countries across the globe. As in previous years, the report notes floods and storms caused the most disaster displacement, including in southeastern Africa, where Cyclone Freddy triggered 1.4 million movements across six countries and territories. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Chad's Prime Minister Success Masra says he ran for president to be the pilot of Chad's flight from poverty to development and democracy. This comes after Masra and his Transformers Party Sunday petitioned Chad's Constitutional Council to annul the results of the May 6 presidential election. Military junta leader and interim president Mohamed Idriss Déby Itno was declared winner with 61.03% and Masra with 18.53%. Masra tells VOA's James Betty that he won the election and calls on the Constitutional Council to ignore the announced results.
You remember that I made it public that considering the result that we have, I won this election. Now the results which is published by the body in charge of the elections, we are candidate. We are not part of when the results came from inside the country to the capital city in Jamena. We were not there to make sure that those are the results which were collected and published. So the main purpose is to ask the Constitutional Court to ignore those results.
Are you claiming, therefore, that the authorities tampered with the ballot?
The results which are published, nobody can testify the fact that they are the truth. And, you know, what the Chadian people are expected is the truth coming from the polls. And actually, the electoral body, which is supposed to publish the results, you know, didn't even invite the candidate to be part of, you know, the reception of those results, which is really very different from what we collected. What we collected is very clear that I won that election.
But, Mr. Prime Minister, the authorities, I think over the weekend, arrested several members of your party because they accused your activists of tampering with the voting process.
You know, I am part of those who designed the electoral law. And in this electoral law, even the citizens of Chad, those who went for the election, at the end of the day, they are authorized to be part of those who will count the results of the election. And this is not what was done. As citizens, they have the right to be there at the end of the, you know, the election and to count, to make sure that what they voted for is the result and what is published is the result of what the citizen voted for. And they were denied this right. And this is one of the arguments we introduced also to the Constitutional Court.
Do you have confidence in this Constitutional Council to render an impartial judgment?
We have to use all the tools available. The electoral body was supposed by law to do a number of things. They didn't do that. And the last milestone, actually, is this Constitutional Court, you know, for us to make sure that they can acknowledge the fact that the electoral body failed. You know, there were a number of tools introducing the law. They were obliged to respect that. The fact that they didn't respect that, we are supposed to take this into consideration, the Constitutional Court.
Mr. Prime Minister, do you have any regrets for accepting the post of Prime Minister and for participating in the election?
Not at all. When you look at the number of Chadian people across the country during the presidential campaign, it was very clear to everybody that the trust in me increased, you know, because people knew that being where I am, it's not for my personal interest. It's to make sure that Chadian people can choose their leaders. And this is why you just have to go and compare the images, you know, of the different campaign that we organize. And then you can see that across the country, even in the diaspora, you know, everywhere, basically, people decided to come in very large, very big number to go for the election. Why? Because they went there to vote for change. And who represent the change for them? It's our project, which represents the change.
Do you still want to be prime minister if it is offered to you again?
Look, there is a political crisis following what happened. I am head of the government. I am candidate. So I am also, the whole administration is under my rule. And I am saying that the results that I have are different from the results that the electoral body put on the place. And if my ambition was to be prime minister, I wouldn't have run for office to be president. You know, I decided that it's up to me to be the main pilot for the next, you know, flight, Chadian flight, to make sure that we can bring about opportunities, etc. I am not looking for a position. I am here to serve the people, and I ask the people of Chad to give me 5 years and to give me the tools which will help me deliver on the ground to make sure that access to electricity, to jobs, clean water, education, health, etc.
That's Chad's Prime Minister, Cesar Masra, speaking with my colleague James Batty. Egypt announced on Sunday its formal support for South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, alleging that Israel has committed human rights crimes in its war against Hamas in Gaza. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry says Cairo is calling for the implementation of the provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice, which requires ensuring the access of humanitarian aid. Ambassador Ayman Zeineldin, former director of the media department at Egyptian Foreign Ministry, discussed the Egyptian move with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Ashenawi.
Egypt has been engaged in numerous court proceedings on the international level, particularly in the International Criminal Court, of which it's a founding member, over the years and since October 7, war broke out. So this might not be the first thing. Egypt took a very active part in another procedure relating to an opinion request by the General Assembly of the United Nations. But in this particular case, I would guess that there were two factors. One relating to the merits of the court proceedings themselves, as Egypt has decided that Israel has passed one important red line after the other in terms of how far the destruction and the killing in Gaza can go. So by attacking Rafah in the way Israel started last week, Egypt found that it cannot stand by idly. The second red line which Israel has crossed is on the diplomatic level. Egypt always restrains itself from going as far as it might wish all the time when it comes to Israel, to keep sufficient channels moving in terms of the diplomatic exercise. In this particular case, trying to reach a deal on the ceasefire and the exchange of prisoners. But what Israel did by walking back on its negotiating commitments and almost lending the process useless, Egypt found that Israel crossed another red line. And I think those two factors were critical in the decision to go ahead and join the court case.
On Friday, South Africa asked the ICJ to order Israel to withdraw from Rafah as part of additional emergency measures in response to the ongoing case over the Gaza war. The Egyptian move to support South Africa's case at The Hague, in which Israel has been accused of breaching its obligations under the UN Genocide Convention, was described by Israeli media as a major diplomatic blow for Tel Aviv on the world stage. Israeli media said that Washington and Jerusalem believe that Egypt is applying pressure on Israel to withdraw its forces from Rafah. Would that perceived pressure produce an Israeli response, or is it just a symbolic move?
Join joining the case will not have an immediate impact because this type of case takes years for the court to issue a ruling. So in a narrowly defined pragmatic sense of the word results, we can't expect something before 3 or 4 years. But on the symbolic level, there is a lot that can be said. And I think symbolism in such cases have far more impact than the word symbolism might connotate. I see that this move by Egypt, as well as President Biden's decision to stop exporting certain weapons to Israel, have a very significant symbolic meaning that sends a very strong signal to Israel, to the Israeli public, to Israeli politicians, that now Israel is losing the main pillars of its strategic balance, the peace with Egypt and the alliance with the United States. If those two important factors are now being threatened, this is a very strong message to the Israeli public. Whether that would result in Israel reacting in the wise way that the world now expects is another matter. Israel of decades past would have got this message and acted as intelligently, smartly. But I'm not sure that the current leadership in Israel and frankly, the current political mood in Israel for the last decade could produce the wise move that the world expects from Israel now.
So how would this position impact the role of Egypt in the ongoing negotiations for a ceasefire deal to release hostages and Palestinian prisoners?
I think Egypt's role is something that it offers the parties to help them climb down from whatever trees they find themselves stuck up. So it's a help Egypt is willing to provide. But the parties are the ones who need Egypt's role and not the other way around. So if Israel wants to find a way out of the current mess, there are a few international actors that can give Israel the way out that Egypt can do. So I would expect Israel to keep its channels with Egypt going on that matter. And frankly, Egypt's role does not depend on the Rafah crossing. It depends on what Egypt can deliver diplomatically with the Palestinians, with Israel and internationally, and that's where its role comes from.
That was Ambassador Ayman Zainuddin, former director of the media department at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry. He spoke with my colleague Mohammed Ashanawi. And that's all we have for you this Tuesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with Dudu Kopa and the song Bandeko. Maître Olivier Mindenge, Maître Yonzi Darcel, Stevie Chebas de la Rébellion, Lendi. We've been listening to Bandeko by Dudu Kopa. I'm your host, Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Cornelius Tanner, Thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Gusto.